welcome to the ICA, where we're very glad to welcome back into the building Slavoj Žižek, who needs no introduction. He's been dubbed an intellectual rock star by the TLS. Yeah. The most dangerous philosopher in the West.
In the world.
Okay, it wasn't Western specific. I mean, the whole world, the most dangerous philosopher. That's by the New Republic, of course, something being a great deal. But he's also the closest we get here at the ICA to a kind of visiting professor, so we're very grateful to him for that. I should also point out that the culture show are filming this evening's performance, so if any of you don't want to end up in an audience for a dangerous radical, then that would be the time to put the bag over your head. So the occasion for Slavoj's visit this evening is that, well, there are two reasons really, two immediate reasons. First of all, he's published a book called First as Tragedy, Then as Farce, which is published by Verso, and it's available in the bookshop, but I urge you all to buy it afterwards. Secondly, he's the star, or at least one of the stars, of a brand new ICA film called Examined Life and Examined Death, which is currently showing at the ICA, and I'd urge you all to see that too. Now, one of the ideas which has been emerging from Slavoj's thinking recently, and one of the ideas which we thought would be most challenging for an audience such as ourselves, would be his ideas, his criticism, or the idea of ecology. Now, ecology, as we all know, is a series of incontestable assumptions or empirical science about the transfer of energy between plants and animals and microorganisms. But it's also evolved into a very powerful system of ideas, something very close to an ideology, and a series of very suggestive metaphors which are increasingly used to understand, for example, how the economy works, the problems which are facing the mainstream media. Artists are increasingly working within an ecological framework and are encouraged to do so. Given so much interest there is in this idea of ecology and the idea of an ecosystem, it does seem astonishing that so few discussions people have about what the system of ideas really means. And one of the things we want to do this evening is to investigate those ideas more closely. So Slavoj is going to present you a lecture looking critically at the complex of ideas surrounding ecology and the idea of ecosystem from a radical perspective. Then, if I have time, I'll ask him a couple of questions, and then we'll throw the discussion over to you, and we'll get to finish just after the later talk. So, Slavoj.
Thanks very much. I'm always glad to be here. And well, this time there was no censorship, because James told me I'm leaving soon, unfortunately, ICA. So you can say all your
so
long,
say
dirty
you
jokes.
If anyone has any problems, if anyone has any customer satisfaction issues as a result of this evening, please take a Valium, because I'm leaving.
On the other hand, please don't be too disappointed, because I really will try to do something quite surprising, actually, in a rather systematic way, make really a couple of points, with no jokes and so on, about ecology. Let me begin by a sphere, a topic where perhaps you don't even suspect of finding a dream of natural balance. But my point here is simply to make you sensitive to where why one finds ideology, and precisely ideology of natural balance, or harmoniously functioning system, as opposed to our human derailment, out of joint society, imbalance, and so on. It is the documentary TV shows on nature, Discovery, and so on, or other reports on the animal kingdom. My reference here is a quite memorable short essay by a French Lacanian, Gerard Weitzman, an essay on, as the title, The Animals That Treat Us Badly, which begins, it was published, a short version of this essay in a small but nice American Lacanian journal, Lacanian Inc. It starts with describing the experience from a trip to an African wilderness park. Here comes a rather long walk. A whole team of tourists traverses the savannah back and forth, arrives on the scene with an engine backfiring and a dust cloud looming to plant themselves 20 meters from three big bad lions. And nothing, as if we didn't exist. Such was my definitive experience with the animal world, a thorough disenchantment, an encounter of the zero type. We do not share animal space. We invade their territory or we cross over it, but we never meet them. The zoo, the circus, state parks, hunting grounds, television channels consecrated to animals, protection societies, nature museums, animal houses of every kind. We multiply the places, the occasions, and the modes of encounter. Humanity passes its time watching the animals. We have invented all kinds of devices expressly for the purpose. We never grow tired of it. No doubt, they, the animals, represent for us a perfect world. Something strange, different from our own, from our uncertain, screwed up, chaotic mess of a world. All of which makes the animal world look that much better. Sometimes it seems so foreign that we stand before their perfection and we are stupefied and mute, stricken, and despite our sincere wishes, we wonder whether we could ever be like them, ever become as marvelous a society as have the ants and the penguins, whereby everyone has his or her place, where everyone is at his or her place, and where everyone knows and does exactly as he or she must, so that everything can keep on in its proper place, so that society can perpetuate itself, unchanged, indefinitely the same, and infinitely perfect. We've had a hard time of it, finding our places. After the disasters of the 20th century, the animal societies seem to have become the ideal. End of quote. The fact that the wild park animals ignore the intruding tourists is crucial. It points towards a double movement of derealization that characterizes utopian fantasies. The scene is presented as a fantasy. Even if it really happens, as is the case here, what renders it phantasmatic is the libidinal investment that determines its meaning. And we, the participants, derealize ourselves. We reduce ourselves to a pure gaze ignored by the objects of the gaze, as if we are not part of reality which we observe, disturbing the wildlife park run of things with our vehicle, but a spectral presence unseen by living beings in the park. We are reduced to spectral entities observing the world without us. As external observers of the paradise barred to us, we assume the same position as the unfortunate Stella Dallas in the final scene of the Hollywood melodrama of the same name. From outside the big house where the ceremony of her daughter's marriage is in progress, Stella watches through the big window the marriage of her daughter and her rich future husband, the paradise of a happy rich family from which she is excluded. And I agree with David Grossman, the Jewish writer, whose idea is that jealousy is, in a way, the ultimate utopia. Jealousy means you imagine a paradise, your wife, no, I will not use the words I'm allowed to use today, something going on and you imagine it, but you are constitutively excluded from it. This utopia accounts for two further phenomena of our recent culture. First, why is the Darwinist reduction of human societies to animal societies, that is to say, the explanation of our human achievements in the terms of evolutionary adaptation, why is it getting so popular? Pop scientific texts abound in journals and reviews reporting on how scientists succeeded in explaining apparently crazy or useless human practices as grounded in adaptive strategies. Why we produce useless luxury to impress the potential sexual partner with our ability to afford such luxury, and so on and so on. In this way, scientists suggest that, another quote from Gerard Weissman, that we might yet have a chance to orient ourselves, to be led over and above our animality. If the subject has a nasty habit of fooling himself all the time, we must bear in mind that nature is never mistaken. Salvation will come in our being animal body. Genes, neurons, and all the rest of it. So whispers the cognitivist in the politician's ears to help them find their way. End of quote. Such reports are thus dreams of how to counteract the growing dysfunctionalization and reflexivity of our postmodern societies, where we can less and less unthinkingly rely on the inherited traditions to provide models for our behavior. Animals don't need any coaching. They just do it. Second, this also explains why we obviously find it so pleasurable to watch endlessly on the specialized TV channels the animal life documentaries, Nature, Animal Kingdom, National Geographic, and so on. They provide a glimpse into the utopian world where no language and training are needed. A view into a harmonious society, as they would have put it today in China, a society in which everyone spontaneously knows his or her role. This is why the case of the National Geographic, the journal even more than the TV channel, is so interesting. Although it combines reports on nature and reports on human societies, the trick, I think, is that it basically treats a human society from a tribe in the midst of Sahara to a small town in the United States as an animal community in which things somehow work, where everyone has his place, where everyone is in his place, and where everyone knows and does exactly as he must, so that everything can keep on in its own, in its proper place. And since the basic inconsistency constitutive of us humans is the discord, impossibility of sexual relationship, no wonder that one of the key elements of our fascination with the animal kingdom are the perfectly regulated rituals of mating. Animals don't have to worry about all the complex fantasies and stimulants to sustain their sexual lust. They are able to, and this is, I think, a wonderful phrase by Weizmann, they are able to have sex ahistorically. Between men and women, it's been pretty messy, the big disorder. Not necessarily unpleasant, of course. It's not war. It's not some kind of permanent fuck-up. It's rather a kind of mixing up and clearing up. No set rule, no rhyme or reason. Not at all as it is with animals, where everybody seems to know perfectly well how to do it, how and with whom and when. The animal world has realized the human dream of sex without a bad story, sex without history, precisely when we humans have gone and invented literature to tell ourselves love stories in which nothing ever happens but a history. We would be happy to put down our books and get straight to the point of what exactly it is to have sex ahistorically. End of quote. Again, from this simple example, all I wanted to demonstrate is precisely how even in such an innocent thing as this TV documentaries, clearly you have a narrative. And again, I insist on my insight that even, what's my point, even when they report about society, you know, all those, I remember, there are some even very amusing, some tribe in the middle of Sahara who can survive, I don't know, a day with 2 dates, practically no water and so on. It's always fascination is always, it functions, things have their established ritual and so on and so on. Okay, and things are interesting here. We should know how to look for signs, for example. This may appear just a bad joke, but I think there is something in it. At least till now, as you probably know, we had in Hollywood the formula of creating a couple. Of course, this forum, especially in the case of big productions about a cosmic catastrophe, displayed the role of what Lacan calls Jacques Lacan plus de jouir, of surplus enjoyment. It's not the focus of the story, it's just the frame, the background which generates the interest in the story. The last example, not a very good movie, unfortunately, if you saw it, 2012. Yes, the whole world comes to an end, but there are even two couples created there. If you saw the movie, you can well imagine the subtitle of the movie is not really a story about how, except 200,000 or what people, all humanity dies. It's rather the story of how an American failed science fiction writer and taxi driver gets back his wife, and so that his family is reconstituted, and so on, and so on. Namely, did you notice how it's, I mean, I don't have a good answer, but I'm intrigued by it. How, first, did you see, which is politically even very, okay, for Hollywood progressive, for example, the last James Bond, Quantum of Solace, politically relatively progressive. You notice, it's basically a movie which starts with solidarity with Aristide, and then basically, to cut a long story short, James Bond saves Morales from right-wing mafia. But did you notice something else? It breaks the rule of all James Bond till now, where, again, as a rule, the concluding moment was always sex staged for and registered by the big other. You know what's the typical conclusion? Finally, Bond is alone with the Bond girl, and just as they try to copulate, you remember, they discover they are filmed or whatever, and then whatever. In this movie with the Ukrainian beauty as the James girl, no sex. At the end, they just discover they are too traumatized and so on and so on. Not even this one. It's even worse with, that's why I hate him. It's even worse with Dan Brown. Namely, it all started with Da Vinci Code, where, as I already developed, the only proper reading of Da Vinci Code is along the lines of X-Files. You know, as my good friend from here, London, Darian Leader, pointed out in X-Files, why do so many things happen out there, all these freaks, aliens invading? To cover up the fact that nothing happens here between, between the guy and the girl, the two angels, no sex. And I think it's exactly the same in Da Vinci Code. Why does even the poor Jesus Christ have to screw Mary? To cover up the fact that, first of all, Robert Langdon doesn't sleep with the girl. No consummation of the act there. First, I thought this is a chance, but then I noticed, did you see, it's a bad movie. Did you see the movie Angels and Demons? Again, even in contrast to the novel, no sex. Did you read, please don't do it, it's one of the most important, but nonetheless, the last novel, The Lost Symbol, absolutely no sex, not even attention. And this is something, I think, quite mysterious, what is happening here. Why? Because till now, the classic formula was, I hope you saw the movie which is so-so, Enigma, the British one with Kate Winslet and so on, where, again, this is typical Hollywood ideology, because I hope you remember how it works. It's the story about Enigma, Bletchley Park, deciphering the German code and so on. And then, as part of the story, the hero is in love with a traumatic, fatal beauty who disappears, remains an enigma. And somewhere in the middle of the movie, they almost openly state the underlying ideology of the film. When somebody says something like, oh, no matter how complicated the German code is, we will finally crack it. But we will never crack the enigma code, the woman, and so on and so on. So, you know, the movie functions precisely through this reverberation of the two levels. And this is disappearing. Why? I don't know, but I don't like it. Okay, so let me return to these nature channels and so on and so on. Why? Against what background do we need nature channels? I think against the background of what, already more than a quarter of a century ago, the German sociologist Ulrich Beck, and don't reduce him to Anthony Giddens. Ulrich Beck is, as far as I know, much more radical politically. For example, one of his books, the title is Capitalism or Democracy, and so on. So Ulrich Beck, you know, deployed the notion of risk society. which, as we all know, focuses on how our contemporary fundamental subjective stance passed from I'm hungry, physical and other needs, to I am afraid. According to Beck, what generates fear today is the causal non-transparency of the threats. Not so much the transcendence of the causes, but their immanence. We don't know to what extent we ourselves bring about the danger. We are not impotent in the face of some natural or divine other. We are becoming all powerful, omnipotent, without understanding our power. And risk is everywhere, and we rely on scientists to cope with it. In contact with a Chinese friend, maybe you know, if you don't, you should learn, it's one wonderful but terrifying detail. The guy told me that they don't want to make it too public, but that in today's China, even those in power secretly admit it, but don't, for obvious reasons, don't make it public, that even the big earthquake, you remember it, a year and a half ago, with many people there, was man-caused. You know how? There are good reasons, they told me, to surmise that the main cause of at least the unexpected strength of that earthquake was the construction of the gigantic Three Gorges dams nearby, which resulted in large, new, as we all know, artificial lakes. The idea is that if you follow the fault lines beneath the surface of the earth, that the additional pressure on the surface seemed to influence the balance of the underground cliffs and thus to contribute to the earthquake. So even something as elementary as an earthquake should also be included into the scope of phenomena influenced by human activity. What's the problem here? The problem is that scientists or experts are perceived as subjects supposed to know the answer, how to cope with these problems, but they don't know. The becoming scientific of our societies has two unexpected features. We more and more rely on experts, even in the most intimate domains of our experience, sexuality, religion, and so on. But this universalization transforms the field of scientific knowledge into an inconsistent, antagonistic non-all. The old Platonic gap between the pluralism of opinions, doxa, and a single universal truth changes into the terrain of conflicting expert opinions themselves. You know, in traditional terms of truth, even this syntagm that we use more and more, expert opinion, is contradictory. Sorry, experts don't have opinions, they are supposed to know. And as is always the case, such universalization involves a self-reflexivity. As Beck perspicuously notices, today's threats are not primarily external, natural, but self-generated by the human activity, permitted by science, the ecological consequences of our industry, the psychic consequences of uncontrolled biogenetics, and so on. So that sciences are simultaneously one of the sources of risks, the sole medium we have to grasp and define the threats. Even if we blame the scientific technological civilization, for example, for global warming, we need the same science not only to define the scope of the threat, but often to perceive the threat. Like, no matter how much you look into the air, you will never see, for example, the ozone hole. You see it only through all the scientific apparatus. And finally, one of the sources of coping with the threat, of maybe finding a way out. The paradigmatic category, which renders this helplessness of sciences and simultaneously covers it up with a deceiving screen of expert assurance, is, and I think this is the crucial term today, to understand how scientific ideology functions, limit value. You know, how much you can still safely pollute your environment, how much fossils can we burn, how much of a poisonous substance doesn't yet threaten your health, and so on and so on. Or, in a racist version, and here I agree with you on this strange interpenetration sometimes on ecological discourse and racist discourse, How many foreigners, which are, as we all know, the poison invading our societies, how many foreigners can our community integrate without endangering our identity? The obvious problem, and incidentally, one of the least glorious persons in this saga is none other than Ernst Jones. In one of the saddest incidents in the history of psychoanalysis, do you know that when Hitler took over the new Germany, because I think it was the brother of Hermann Göring who was one of the main psychiatrists, offered psychoanalysts a silent pact, which is allow us to throw out the Jews and to change a little bit terminology. We will not call it psychoanalysis, but dynamic, the term comes from there, dynamic psychology and so on, and your psychoanalysis can go on. The deal was made by Ernst Jones. Freud was horrified, but had no way but to accept it, and it worked till 43, 44, where they made, and when Germany was bombed, you know, psychoanalytic studies of shock effects, traumatic effects of bombing, and so on and so on. And at that inglorious moment, Ernst Jones even, I quote it in my next book, I don't have the quote, but it's horrible to find how he even, again, accepted this topic of German racism and so on, and generated some very obscure reflections on, are Germans right or no? How many Jews you can still integrate without, you know, for him the problem was strictly, if he had any criticism at all of Germany, is that they set the standard too low. Like, no, it's not 3-4%, you should start worrying only when you have 6-7% of the Jews or whatever. The obvious problem here is that due to the non-transparency of the situation, every limit value has the aspect of a fiction, of an arbitrary symbolic intervention into the real. For example, the example is here my own. I have now some kind of stupid diabetes, and I don't know, do you measure it here the American or the European way? In European numbers, the limit is usually set to 6.5. Don't ask me of what, I only know the numbers. If it's more is bad, if it's less is good. But how do we really know that this number means anything? That, you know, 6.6, oh, catastrophe, 6.4, oh, you can even maybe have another praline or another chocolate. Purely, you set an arbitrary parameter here. Unfortunately, and that's my problem with fighting Holocaust. Of course we should fight it, but I was told by a historian that even when they try to regulate in a politically correct way, when do you enter the domain of Holocaust denial, they seriously try to quantify it, you know. The number they fix on is usually 5 million. So, you know, if you say 5 million, 1,000 Jews were killed, it's okay, good. If you say 4,900,000 Holocaust denial, and so on and so on. Are limit values not cases of what Thomas Schelling, the rational choice theorist, not the German idealist, called, in a very nice theory, focal points. According to Schelling, real human interactions are not governed by pure strategic calculus, which can be formalized, but by focal points, which are invisible under a mathematical formulation of the problem. Here is Schelling's most famous example. I arranged with a friend to meet him next day in New York. But due to the breakdown of all communications, neither of us knows where and when to meet. I only know tomorrow at noon. When Schelling asked his students what to do, what they would have done in such a situation, the majority suggested to go to the clock at the Grand Central Station at noon. It is the meeting point which imposed itself as the most obvious one to a person from our culture, of course. The reasoning is here more complex than it may appear. When I posit a focal point, I do not only try to guess which is for both of us the most obvious point. The question I try to answer with my choice is, What do I expect the other to expect that I expect of him? When next day I go to the Grand Central station, the clock, under the clock at noon, I do so because I expect that my friend expects me to expect of him to go there. In negotiations, the focal point can be an irrational, in the sense of not grounded in any rational strategic calculation, an irrational, based on pure decision, commitment which fixes a non-negotiable feature. For the state of Israel, the control over the entire Jerusalem is non-negotiable. Ahead of salary negotiations, a trade union leader announces that he will never settle for less than 5% rise, and so on and so on. There are, of course, always ways to compromise while sticking to the letter of one's engagement. Say, the trade union leader can accept that the 5% rise will be gradual. It will spread over 5, even 10 years. But nonetheless, such an engagement raises the stakes. You cannot abandon its letter without, as we put it, losing your face. In contrast to purely strategic reasoning, such commitment is not psychological, but properly symbolic. It is performative, grounded in itself. You just pause it, 5%. And you can clearly see how limit value is ultimately precisely just another case of Schelling's focal point, which is in itself another name for what Lacan called the quilting point, and later the master signifier. So again, that's maybe the first zero level to say, you know, when we talk about all these magical formulas of ecological discourse, sustainability, the limit, how much to pollute, and so on, that we are definitely not talking about science. We are talking about symbolic fictions, especially with sustainability. I think this is maybe the greatest myth. It sounds nice, but scientists convince me it's scientifically total nonsense. It just involves a myth of, precisely a myth of somehow, how should I put it, closing the circle. No wonder that the nearest you come in other countries to sustainability is, you know, in our beloved, the last surviving true democracy, North Korea. You know that now, 2-3 months ago, they passed a new constitution where they even dropped out the name, any reference to Marxism, communism, or whatever. Now it's just a purely patriotic military grounding of the regime with, you know what, that great idea that they have on Juche, so-called Juche, self-reliance, which means sustainability. So, you know, we are learning from Kim Il-sung and so on, no matter how we love it. Now, let's raise the stake a little bit, raise the stake. Of course, I'm not claiming that in ecology we are dealing just with imaginary points and so on, all this kind of purely voluntarist, irrational focal points. No. All limits do not have this status where we, in an arbitrary way, fix a limit. There we are approaching, at some point, how should I put it, zero level. I claim that zero level in the sense of possible ecological breakdown or biological reduction of humans to manipulable machines, total digital control over our lives, and so on. At all these levels, things are approaching a kind of apocalyptic zero point. If you want to put it in pathetic terms, the end of time is near. Again, I'm not now preaching a new version of 2012. I'm just saying that obviously, for example, in ecology, we are approaching a limit. I'm not saying this limit is the 31st of December 2012 and so on, but I'm saying that something radical is happening. Something radical in the sense that it cannot go the way it goes indefinitely. If you want a wonderful example, I wonder if it was reported also in your media. A couple of days ago even, in the United States, this was big news. Do you know what is Sixth Sense? You can check it on YouTube. This is a scientist, I think, of Indian origins called not mystery, but mystery without E, mystery, at MIT lab, who, with